versus Lysa. Mr. Davis, good morning to you.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. My name is James Martin Davis. I'm an attorney in Omaha. I represent the plaintiff's appellate in this case. The plaintiffs are Rachel, Edie, and Jeff Lott and their children. The defendants are Leasing Properties, which is the owner of the residence that grew up, and CPM is also a defendant. They were the managers of this property that blew up. This is an action in tort where my client sued both of the defendants arising out of a natural gas explosion that took place at property owned by the lessees and managed by CPA. As a result of that explosion, my client's house was destroyed. They were injured, and so were their parents. Now, the assignments of error in this case relate to the fact that the judge in this case granted a motion to dismiss under 12B, under Rule 12B, and basically what they did is dismiss the case and dismiss it with prejudice. So the argument here, the two assignments of error we have, is that the trial court erred in dismissing the plaintiff's amended complaint and ruling as a matter of law that the plaintiff's amended complaint failed to identify a legal duty. Assignment error number one. Number two is trial court compounded its error by dismissing the plaintiff's amended complaint with prejudice and failing to grant leave to amend the complaint. Now, pretty simple arguments here. Number one, they shouldn't have dismissed it. And to anticipate your questions, Chief Justice, the scope of review for the first is de novo as it results to the assignment number two, the scope of error with respect to dismissing case with prejudice is abuse of discretion. However, it's a limited discretion that they have with respect to not allowing a party to amend a complaint. You do that all the time, unless it's futile to do so, or it's in bad faith, or other exceptions under the law.
Mr. Davis, I'd like to... You take the position, I think, that your operative complaint did state a cause of action and did sufficiently allege facts from which duty could be determined.
That's right.
So far, so good. Assuming that was not sufficient, how would an amended complaint, how could you fix the problem?
Well, first of all, you can allege a common law duty, but you don't have to anticipate ahead of time what you're going to do. The judge says, okay, you have an opportunity to amend it, see if you can fix it. It's up to the plaintiff to do it. But, it's a pretty clear case here. When I started law school, I had Justice Wright and Justice Stevens were classmates of mine. That was 50 years ago. We had something called code pleading, and that's what we learned about.
I'm a little younger, and I remember it, too.
Oh, yes. And then when I went to Indiana and finished Indiana, where Dan Quayle was my classmate, they taught us notice pleading. Indiana had adopted early on the federal rules. Now, Nebraska, not surprisingly, belatedly adopted that. You might remember in 2013, or 2003, the legislature adopted, I think it was 876, and it changed it. And remember, we had to delete all those parts of Chapter 25, and then the Supreme Court adopted these nice rules of practice, and we adopted notice pleading. Now, in this complaint, why we ask you to do this, and why the court wants to give somebody an opportunity to amend it, is because it's a matter of judicial economy, and it's a matter of preventing judge shopping. I mean, if I had this case, and I tried it, Judge Otepka, overruled it. I just refile it, pay my filing fee, and get another judge. Do you want that?
You're focusing on the with prejudice aspect.
Well, I'm focusing on both. I mean,
let me go back to your assignments. Your assignments of error include also the denial of the motion to amend.
That's correct.
So which complaint, the amended complaint or the proposed second amended complaint, do you like better?
Well, I think generally, just to give you an example, just in the last 6 months, I've had a couple of cases like this. Judge Doerr, I want a motion to dismiss. He automatically, without motion, he says, okay, defendant, you got 14 days to file a medical complaint. And in front of Judge Randall, an intentional tort case, same thing. He says, okay, you've got 30 days to file a medical complaint. You don't need to leave a court ahead of time as a result of a motion to dismiss. You don't leave a court to file an amended complaint.
Prior to a ruling.
Yeah, prior to a ruling. If you, the rules are, if I want to file an amended complaint and I see something wrong with it, I got to go to court and get leave of court. But as a matter of course, if my case is dismissed for some technicality, the judge almost routinely says, okay, you have time to file an amended complaint. Because the alternative is just filing again some other court. We don't want that.
Let me see if I'm following the history here procedurally. How old was this case when the motion to dismiss with prejudice was granted based on the amended complaint?
Well, I think it was 2016.
How many months or years had it been pending?
Less than a year. I don't remember.
So let's say it was filed in December 16, and then that was a ruling in this May or something.
Okay. Right. He's good. The statute hasn't run. You could file it. You could file it again to court. Just get somebody other than Judge Otepka. Maybe get a plaintiff's judge.
You know, let's see how this all played out, because there was a motion to dismiss and then the plaintiff didn't ask for leave to file or submit a proposed another complaint, then plaintiffs got a ruling, right? After the ruling to dismiss, plaintiffs came in and asked for leave to file another amended complaint.
Yeah, and it's different. Well, that's proper. If the judge doesn't give you that, the lawyer in this case did it completely differently than I would have done, and I wouldn't pled it like it was pled here. But in instance, what he did is ask for a motion for new trial and wanted the judgment set aside or whatever.
But you'd want to set aside a judgment before you could amend. In any event, what's our jurisprudence say about a party who comes in and seeks leave to file an amended complaint after a motion to dismiss had been granted? Or have we written about it?
No, I don't know that there are any cases along those lines. I mean, I think as a matter of, you can't, if your case is going to be dismissed because it's defective, it's not going to be dismissed with prejudice. It's just going to be dismissed. And so the court generally, as a matter of course, says you got 14 days to file an amended complaint. I would have asked for leave if the judge didn't give it to me.
Counsel, is it significant to our analysis that an amended complaint had already been filed, and then all the briefing with respect to the motion to dismiss occurred, and the plaintiff stood on that amended complaint? Is that significant to our analysis?
No, I don't think so. I mean, because how many times you can have third amended complaints, fourth amended complaints? You see that all the time. I mean, with respect to what we've got in cases like, you've got motions for summary judgment to address any problems. You've got a motion to make more definite certain. The motions for summary judgment, even the federal courts say are disfavored. You got a motion for a directed verdict if there's no legal theory there. That's where you address the concerns that Judge Otepka had. And if there's no legal theory or no duty there, then you file a motion for a directed verdict. You know, that what they're saying is that in order to recover, you must show a legal duty owed by the defendant to the plaintiff and a breach of a duty and a causation. That's true. But we're not talking about a recovery here. A recovery is when you win. You know, we're talking about the early stages. I agree, you got to have a legal duty if you're going to get money.
So what was the legal duty here?
Well, let's say this. Let's say, same scenario. The tenant leaves, but the tenant had a meth factory in the basement, and he left it. And then all of a sudden, boom, the house blows up. Isn't there a duty there to, under the common law, to maintain and keep your premises safe, even though it's a rental property? And it causes, how about if the tenant was raising diamondback rattlesnakes in the garage.
But neither the complaint nor the amended complaint here alleged a hazardous operation of land or any hazardous use.
So
right?
What?
Instead, it raised a res ipsa theory and then specific acts of negligence all combined.
But
Isn't that right?
Under the notice, but it really doesn't have to, Judge. I mean, you do that. You don't have to raise the elements of negligence or the particulars of negligence anymore. And a notice, please, you flesh that out later.
Have we ever said that?
Federal courts say it all the time. And we file with the federal betterment. I thought I had time for a rebuttal, but I... Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Cooper, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. Good morning, Mr. Court. May it please the court. Your Honor, my name is Pat Cooper. I'm with Fraser Stryker in Omaha, and I represent Certified Property Management Company, one of the appellees. Ms. Kamler is with the Ingalls Ketchum Law Firm in Omaha. She represents Lifey Properties. Our interests, we believe, for purposes of this appeal, are aligned. It's our intention that I'll be handling the argument on behalf of both appellees. Ms. Kamler is available, though, in the event the court thinks there are any issues or questions that are unique to the property owner, Lifey Properties. I want to start with the duty issue.
That is fine. And Ms. Kamler, you can sit down if you wish. Thank you.
I want to start with the duty issue, if I may. This is, I think, a case where the plaintiffs could have sued a party that had a duty to them, but they chose to sue parties that did not owe them a duty. If you look at each iteration of the complaint that's in the record, there are allegations specifically about the parties who created the risk of harm in this case. The tenant and her moving personnel are the individuals who were negligent in disconnecting the dryer in the property and allowing the property to fill with natural gas. They're the parties that there's a valid cause of action against and the plaintiffs may be able to seek redress from, but the property owner and the property manager are not parties that owe a legal duty to the next door neighbors in this situation. And I think what I was waiting to hear some argument about was how this case can be distinguished from the Bell case that was decided just last week, where the court undertook an analysis of the third restatement of torts, looked at Section 7 and Section 37, and made it very clear that an actor, a party, does not owe a duty of reasonable care to someone unless you created a risk of harm to that individual. And there's no allegation in any version of the complaint in this record that any affirmative action was taken by either Lifey Properties or Certified Property Management Company to create a risk of harm.
What do you think our jurisprudence says, if I have the procedure right? There's a motion to dismiss, and somewhere along the line there's the amended complaint, and that's the complaint that is dismissed with prejudice, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then after that ruling, the dismissal ruling, plaintiffs come in and ask for leave to file the second amended complaint.
Yes, Your Honor.
And have we addressed that? And if so, what is the standard at the trial level and what's our standard of review?
I don't think you've addressed that specific fact scenario, at least not that I could find. And that's why at the trial court level I borrowed from the Eighth Circuit and found case after case after case where the Eighth Circuit has analyzed this very situation and said, the standard of review continues to be abuse of discretion. We continue to give our trial courts considerable discretion in making a decision about whether to grant leave to amend in that situation. It's different, though, because based on the timing, we have to give some respect to interests of finality. And we can't have situations where counsel comes in and contests legal theories and contests sets of facts and seek an advisory opinion from the court about whether that set of facts states a claim upon which relief may be granted, and then once they get an order from the court, come back and change the facts to fit the court's analysis, and now come back and say, I've got a proposed amended complaint now that I'd like to put forward, Your Honor.
So the trial judge said, with respect to leave to file,
yes,
a second amended complaint.
Yes, Your Honor.
You were put on notice. There was a motion to dismiss. You could have cleaned this up or something like that, right? And that the delay. We're interested in finality, right?
That was part of the analysis, yes.
Right, okay. So how long had the case been pending?
The case had been pending for about 5 months. It was filed in December of 2016. Mm-hmm. The complaint was amended once, as a matter of course, by plaintiff's counsel. The motions to dismiss were filed, I think, the first week in February or the last week in January. And the briefing by the defendants was done at least 2 months in advance of the hearing on the motion to dismiss. So part of the trial court's exercise of discretion in this case was to look at the fact that the plaintiffs were on notice for months about the defects, or at least the alleged defects, in their pleading, and they made a strategic decision to stand on that pleading and not seek leave to amend. That's one factor that the Eighth Circuit, at least, has commented is an appropriate factor for a trial court to consider when it's exercising its discretion. I think the other factor that comes into play that this court has discussed is the issue of futility of amendment. And I think that's a factor that also comes into play here, because if you look at the second proposed second amended complaint, respectfully, it suffers from the same fatal flaw that the first complaint and the amended complaint suffered from.
In what respect?
It still doesn't allege a legal duty that was owed by these defendants to these plaintiffs. It still alleges a theory that we were negligent in supervising the move-out process, that we were negligent in failing to intervene to prevent damages that were caused by a risk of harm that was created by somebody else.
So would there be a duty if the owners were on notice or constructive notice of the problem, of the tenants removing the gas dryer?
Sure. The amended complaint that was the basis of the order of dismissal did not allege that. The proposed second amended complaint did change the factual allegations and not artfully pled, but it may suggest some element of notice. I don't think that does change the analysis, though, on the duty issue, because, again, simply knowing about a risk of harm doesn't trigger a duty owed to a third party. The risk of harm was still created by the tenant and the moving personnel, right? And so you now look to the restatement third, section 7 and 37, say, because we didn't create that risk of harm, we didn't engage in any affirmative act that created the risk of harm, therefore we don't owe a legal duty unless you get into the special relationships that are found in sections, I think, 38 through 44 of the restatement third. I would acknowledge that under section 40 of the restatement, a landlord-tenant relationship can be a special relationship. But section 40 deals with those relationships where one party to the relationship may owe a duty to the other party in the relationship. So did the landlord owe a duty to the tenant? So if this was the tenant suing the landlord, maybe it's a different case under the special relationship
analysis.
This is a
contiguous neighbor.
So that
is that right? That's our facts.
It's a neighbor next door, correct.
Yeah.
So they never came onto the property. We never get to premises liability theories of recovery because they weren't entrants on the land. I think there's some suggestion in the briefing that Section 51 of the Restatement Third of Torts would apply, but because they didn't enter onto the property, the plaintiffs never came onto the property.
How about Section 54 in the restatement?
And I'm not familiar with 54, Your Honor.
Are you familiar with Section 371 in the second restatement?
I'm not, Your Honor.
So is there a duty from one contiguous neighbor to the other under some set of facts?
I don't think so. I think that's still a premises liability theory of recovery. I don't think we get there. The only way, I think you look to Section 41 of the restatement third, which is the only way you could possibly get there. You have to find there's a special relationship under the Section 41 analysis. If you look at Section 41, there are very few relationships that rise to the heightened level where that
So we've been picking those up one at a time depending on the facts if you're reading opinions on Friday.
I understand, right? Your
okay.
Honor.
So, but we haven't necessarily had a special relationship under this set of facts, I think.
I'm not aware of any court anywhere in the country that has found a landlord-tenant relationship to give rise to a Section 41 special relationship that would give rise to a third party.
So in your brief, you say the tenants moved out on, was it a Saturday?
Well, the tenant actually had already moved out under this.
Or came for the dryer on the 23rd.
The tenant had moved out of the property at some previous date, but under the statutory obligations under the Landlord-Tenant Act, were required to give them access to the property to pick up their personal belongings.
Okay.
So they returned to the property really after the special relationship, to the extent there even was one, had already terminated. They picked up their personal belongings, and then the explosion happens the following Monday morning when our client walks into the property.
Okay.
Suppose there was no tenant involved at all in this circumstance, and that the dryer had been properly capped off, but due to the passage of time in an unoccupied structure, a leak occurred. Would the owner of the structure that blew up have liability for a trespass occurring to the contiguous neighbor?
You're saying just remove the tenant from this situation,
would my client have liability
to that neighbor?
If there's no tenant involved, is the owner's house that blows up and affects the neighbor, causes harm to the neighbor, that a tort, and if so, what kind?
I think you have to look back to the restatement third and analyze whether there was any conduct of the owner that created a risk of harm. And in the absence of some act that created that risk of harm, it's a terribly unfortunate situation, but there's no legal duty owed to those people next door, and therefore no viable cause of action.
So add to that that it was properly capped off, but nobody inspected it for a year. They don't do periodic inspections. The leak occurs and it persists long enough. Couldn't the absence of inspections at some point lead to liability when the house blows up and affects the neighbor?
I think now you're getting into the very analysis in Bell about at what point is the conduct of an actor sufficient to be considered creating a risk of harm. We're dealing with literally a lapse of hours in our case, and you have to recall...
I think Justice Castle is just saying the existence of a harm, not necessarily the creation of a harm, on your property that you possess. Pardon me.
And I understand the legal theory at issue in this case is a failure to supervise. It's a failure to intervene to prevent harm that was caused by the affirmative acts of somebody
else. Let's say the court doesn't recognize that as a duty, but perhaps the court recognizes that a possessor of land has a duty to the neighbor to not have a dangerous condition on its property. Then what would be your response?
My response would be, I think before that duty can give rise, there has to be some allegation of notice. There is no such allegation of notice in the original complaint or in the amended complaint.
Pardon me, in the second amended complaint, paragraph 5, that wasn't permitted, it says the evicted tenants on or before July 25 removed items from rental property. However, tenants so supervised by the management company removed unlawfully a gas clothes dryer that was not their property and did not terminate the gas flow to the dryer, all done in the presence or with the knowledge of the management company.
So that's the proposed second amendment.
That's complaint. The one that didn't get permitted, but it's saying the management company was there. I don't know if true or not, but we accept it as true in a pleading if it were filed.
Understand, Your Honor. Okay. It's false, but in any event, I understand okay. That at that point, that allegation was made in a proposed second amendment complaint.
Okay.
So now we're looking at the trial court's exercise of discretion. Is there a bright line rule in Nebraska that if you, after dismissal of a complaint, if there's a viable petition put forward, that the trial court must give leave to file that complaint? Of course not. There are plenty of factors that the trial court can consider, and in this case did consider. So I don't think the proposed second amendment complaint stated a viable theory of recovery. I think there's no duty alleged in that case, but even if it did, I think what Judge Otepka did in this case was well within the considerable discretion that we give trial courts. For that reason, I think this court should affirm the decision of the district court. I see that I'm out of time, so thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. We will go on to the